because of the fact that, you know, if that happens, then these people are not going to be covered. And of course, we're looking at the post-pandemic, hopefully it's going to arrive with a vaccine. Anyways, we are now going to be joined by former U.S. presidential candidate and Senator Mike Gravel from Springfield, Massachusetts. Mike Gravel, welcome to Decision 2020. Both Trump and Biden talked about health care plans. We just heard what they said, and each had their own plan for the Affordable Care Act. But to this day, millions of Americans still don't have health care in the U.S. Do you think this will change, or what the two candidates have said is just for the sake of campaigning, do you think?
First off, if Biden gets elected, it will change. And it may not change exactly the way Biden is representing. Biden is still trying to act like a moderate in this regard, but the progressives under Bernie Sanders and others are pushing very hard for health care for all. And so I think the first push is going to be to turn around and arrange for Medicare to come down to $60 to $50 and try to absorb the volumes of people that way. And at the same time, going out and making sure that what's left of Obamacare is covering the 20 million people that aren't covered. So there's no question in my mind that a Democratic leadership will attempt and succeed in covering everybody's health care needs in the foreseeable future.
Okay, I'm going to thank Mike Gravel there. We appreciate it, Mike. He's the former U.S. presidential candidate and U.S. senator. Well, let's go back in time here and look at 4 years ago. President Trump rode a hard line on immigration to the Republican nomination and ultimately the White House. And when the topic came up on Thursday night's debate, however, he tried to downplay some of the more extreme steps that he has taken while in office.
When asked about his administration's policy of separating the children from the parents of undocumented migrants, Trump tried to turn the conversation to the detention facilities created by the Obama administration to house unaccompanied minor immigrants. Biden was quick to respond. He noted that the children Trump was detaining came over with their parents and that the policy was making the U.S. a laughing stock.
Another question to you.
These 500 plus kids came with parents. They separated them at the border to make it a disincentive to come to begin with. They're real tough. We're really strong. And guess what? They cannot, it's not coyotes didn't bring them over. Their parents were with them. They got separated from their parents. And it makes us a laughing stock and violates every notion of who we are as a nation.
The two sides then clashed over race, with Trump once again insisting that he is the least racist president America has ever had.
I am the least racist person in this room.
In the first presidential debate, Trump talked himself into trouble when the topic turned to race relations, as he danced around whether to directly condemn white supremacist groups. This time around, the president was considerably more quick. He boasted about his bipartisan criminal justice reform and funding for historically black colleges. But still, figures show that many American voters see him as a racist person.
I was just appalled by how he was trying to paint this picture of suburban women falling into his camp and being as racist as he is. We ask all of our members to send it. It's basically a letter from management telling him he's fired and that he does not have the vote of suburban women, that he does not know what we want or what we're looking for or how we feel. He doesn't speak for us.
Okay, let's bring in our next guest on the show. Another senator, I promise you, former member of the Virginia State Senate, Richard Hayden Black, joins us. Richard, welcome. Let's take a look at the U.S. president calling the undocumented immigrants people with the lowest IQ. He also avoided to talk about white supremacy and instead attacked the Black Lives Matter protesters. What kind of message do you think he wants to send Americans? I mean, what kind of Americans will people see as the president for the next 4 years? if he's going to be the one that they're going to elect.
The Black Lives Matter is not simply a race-based group. About 70% of them are white, and they are a Marxist group. They're a revolutionary group, and they really are seeking an overthrow of the government.
Interesting that you say that. BLM, or Black Lives Matter, is a group that was created mainly due to police brutality against African Americans, which then morphed into discriminations against blacks. Its members actually are mostly African Americans.
Okay, we appreciate that. That's Richard Hayden Black, former member of the Virginia State Senate, talking to us there. Thank you so much for that. Well, let's take a look at some media posts, social media posts on this. Frank Luntz writing, "My focus group's words to describe Trump tonight: control, deserve, boys, con artist, surprisingly presidential." And on Biden, "vague, unspecific, elusive, defensive, and grandfatherly." The last one leaves a bit of a question mark here. Okay, the next tweet comes from Ella Wild, who said, "For me, the most vile thing Trump said was good as a response to the comment that he had separated 500-plus kids and now has no idea where the parents are. Well, as a parent, this is devastating. Also, Donald blatantly ignores the question about systemic racism." Now, that we do know about Trump in terms of systemic racism, how he ignores that somewhat. But in terms of the, you know, the separation, I mean, you know, that truly is representation of Trump, separating kids from their families. Well, in the final presidential debate before Election Day, Trump and Biden were asked to relay what they would say on Inauguration Day to voters who did not support their candidacies. This is what they said.
In the end, when asked what they would say to the American voters, Trump focused his remarks on the economy and touted the low unemployment rates across a variety of demographics.
Success is going to bring us together. We are on the road to success, but I'm cutting taxes, and he wants to raise everybody's taxes, and he wants to put new regulations on everything. He will kill it. If he gets in, you will have a depression the likes of which you've never seen.
Biden, meanwhile, said he will be a president who represents all Americans, including those who did not cast their ballot for him, and said he will put science over fiction.
What is on the ballot here is the character of this country: decency, honor, respect, treating people with dignity, making sure that everyone has an even chance. And I'm going to make sure you get that. You haven't been getting it the last 4 years.
This was the last debate before the 2020 election. The U.S. President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden laid out starkly different versions of America as they met on the debate stage on Thursday night. Now it's all up to the American voters and also the electoral colleges.
All right, time for third-party candidates and independents. I told you we're going to cover them. I mean, these are voices that matter, and some are actually on the ballot, but you wouldn't know it. You, meaning Americans, and also the ones outside of the U.S. Well, we cover them here, and here's what some of them had to say on social media. Let's take a look. First, going on to Joe Jurgensen, who is the Libertarian candidate, who made a point, that is, to highlight how both candidates focused on each other's corruption based on the debate, adding, "How can you trust either with our economy, taxpayer money, or to act ethically at the White House?" She also said that voting for more government spending inevitably leads to higher taxes to pay for it, now or in the future, which she said would slash federal spending and make government much smaller. Next, Howie Hawkins from the Green Party. He proposed the Green New Deal back in 2010, saying how another decade has passed for failing to act on it, with no hopes pinned on Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Next up, Rocky De La Fuente of the Alliance Party. He said both Biden and Trump made fools of themselves, adding that Latinos and Hispanics are tired of both parties who don't include independent parties. Here's Don Blankenship, the Constitution candidate. He says here that Washington, D.C. has a spending party. Americans who pay taxes are not invited, but they're the ones who are going to pay the bill. And finally, tweet five is from Brock Pierce, an independent candidate, who said the U.S. two-party system is the same side of the same coin. Real change is needed, something to emerge that transcends partisan politics. Time now for a surprise. Let me test your memory here. Do you know who this man is? Well, this is none other than world-famous Noam Chomsky, who is a U.S. linguist and philosopher. And These are his thoughts on some very important issues not covered by the candidates, and his views. Things that mainstream media don't cover, but we do on Decision 2020.
There's no coherent leadership. It's chaotic. The presidency, the White House, is in the hands of a sociopathic megalomaniac. Among his voting base, there are lots of people who don't like international organizations. Think we're on top, we should be by ourselves, nobody tells us anything. So it's, you know, it's good to pick up some votes from these sectors if you defund and maybe move on to disband the WHO. Of course, it has consequences. As soon as Trump came in, his first move was to dismantle the entire pandemic prevention machinery and to start defunding the Center for Disease Control, which would maybe 70% of the population, something roughly like that, that just gets by from one week to the next, one paycheck to the next paycheck. Anything goes wrong, they don't have anything. The United States doesn't have a very weak unemployment insurance as compared to other countries.
How do you like that for an ending? That does it for today. Don't forget to catch our next episode. I've been Kamit Atley. On behalf of the whole team here, thanks. Until next time.
In the limelight.
Progressive critics and election analysts have long been warning of a nightmare scenario in which Trump falsely declares himself the winner on November 3rd based on an early lead in in-person votes and proceeds to declare all votes counted after Election Day illegitimate. The president's comments recently bolstered those fears. Donald Trump is planning to do everything he can to make sure your vote doesn't count. Progressive advocacy group, Indivisible, part of a coalition planning mass protests should Donald Trump attempt to steal the election, said in response to the president's remarks recently, which came hours after the conservative-dominated Supreme Court ruled that the battleground state of Wisconsin cannot extend its Election Day deadline for the arrival of mail-in ballots. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "I don't believe that's by our laws," Trump says of counting all the votes in an election. Stay tuned, please, to hear more about this issue. Repeating his desire for a winner to be declared on the night of November 3rd, U.S. President Donald Trump told reporters on Tuesday, October 27th, that he doesn't believe tallying votes for weeks after Election Day is lawful, a remark observers interpreted as yet another open signal of the U.S. president's intention to challenge the counting of legally submitted ballots. "It would be very, very proper and very nice if a winner were declared on November 3rd instead of counting ballots for 2 weeks, which is totally inappropriate. And I don't believe that's by our laws," Trump said before departing the White House for a campaign rally in Lansing, Michigan. "I don't believe that, so we will see what happens." It is in fact perfectly legal for states to count ballots for weeks after the election. Some U.S. states allow mail-in ballots to arrive up to 2 weeks after November 3rd, as long as they are postmarked by Election Day. Due to the unprecedented surge in mail-in voting sparked by the pandemic, the process of tallying ballots and determining the election winner is expected to take longer than usual. He wants to throw out legal votes. That's what he's saying here, tweeted Grant Frank Ruta, executive editor of GEN magazine. Progressive critics and election analysts have long been warning of a nightmare scenario in which Donald Trump falsely declares himself the winner on November 3rd based on an early lead in in-person votes and proceeds to declare all votes counted after Election Day illegitimate. The president's comments on Tuesday, October 27th, bolstered those fears. Donald Trump is planning to do everything he can to make sure your vote doesn't count. Progressive advocacy group Indivisible, part of a coalition planning mass protests should Trump attempt to steal the election, said in response to the president's remarks recently, which came hours after the conservative-dominated U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the battleground state of Wisconsin cannot extend its Election Day deadline for the arrival of mail-in ballots. In his concurring opinion in the case, Trump nominated Justice Brett Kavanaugh parroted the U.S. president's attack on the common state practice of counting ballots that arrive after Election Day, a possible indication that Kavanaugh is, as Slate's Mark Joseph Stern put it, open to stealing the election for Trump. The implications of Kavanaugh's reason could reach beyond Wisconsin, as Stern pointed out on Twitter. North Carolina Republicans are already citing Kavanaugh's argument to justify their own push for the Supreme Court to limit the state's absentee ballot deadline. Brett Kavanaugh's stunning opinion recently should be a huge story today, said Stern. It casts aspersions on mail ballots. It's riddled with errors. It endorses a theory too radical for the Bush v. Gore majority. It's a preemptive attack on our election's integrity.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the World with Reporters.
Cab drivers in Barcelona shut down traffic over lack of government support days after regional authorities imposed a 10 p.m. curfew to limit the spread of the coronavirus. They say they're still waiting for the European Emergency Fund and blame the regional and central governments for not doing enough to help them with the economic fallout of the pandemic.
They have to expedite late payments. They have to put a freeze on the repayment of loans to the banks, otherwise we are dead. They have to bail us out like they did with banks, to bail out everybody, not only cab drivers, but all those who cannot meet their payments.
Taxi representatives who met with the regional transportation officials say they came out empty-handed after they were told to wait for details of the relief funds and provisions decided by Madrid. Juan Luque, one of the 10,500 licensed cab drivers in Barcelona, says he may have to give up his job as the government's moratorium on loan repayment comes to an end, and the bank prepares to seize his vehicle for payment default.
The European Relief Fund will not reach us before January or February. For now, only the state has unblocked some funds for 3 months that many are still waiting to cash. I personally got paid only 1 month out of three. I survived by dipping in my savings, and when things get tougher, I will have to take a new loan from family or from the bank.
Critics say the taxi industry has done little to adapt to the rapidly changing urban mobility, as cash-strapped riders seek cheaper, safer modes of transportation.
We can't. The authorities are the ones who set prices, working hours, bank holidays. We had to regulate our business model ourselves. Look at public transportation. It seems COVID does not go down there. They shut down restaurants and bars, and they turn their eyes away when people cram metros and buses.
With a night curfew looming, protesters called off their strike, but they vowed to return and camp out until their demands are met.
While the long-time view is that the taxi industry will eventually recover from the COVID crisis, the question is at what cost, and if policymakers and mobility providers can take advantage of an over-congested public transit to offer cost-effective solutions to riders and commuters. Cusay Kadri, Barcelona.
Foul-smelling atmosphere in France against Muslims since earlier this month when France led a national tribute to a teacher who was beheaded by a Chechen teenager after showing his class the offensive caricatures of the Prophet of Islam. Now a witch hunt against Muslim associations has been launched by the French government. This came after French Interior Minister Darmanin declared the Committee Against Islamophobia, CCIF in France, is a backroom for Islamists who strive against the Republic. It is an enemy of the Republic. The Interior Minister repeated that there is apparently an enemy from within that has to be fought. These declarations are increasing tensions amongst the French population. The pressure is so high that the CCIF announced in a statement that it plans to expand its activities outside the European country amid concerns for its safety in the wake of Macron's remarks.
The state cannot admit its role in the rise of racism because it's responsible for an institutional racism, a real Islamophobia. The CCIF is continuously exposing it. In 2020, more than 450 cases of Islamophobia have been registered. Every time, they point to the responsibility of the state and underline the discrimination Muslims suffer from and that the state does not tolerate.
The declaration of the French minister is not an isolated one. A wave of Islamophobia and racism is rushing over France. Masks have fallen. The mainstream media and most of the political establishment spread their hatred against Islam, against migrants, every day.
We clearly see that there is a societal and institutional racism that keeps rising today, especially Islamophobia, because now there is public condemnation of the Muslim community. They are making a confusion and amalgame about Muslims. They keep pointing the finger and stigmatizing an entire community.
The normalization of Islamophobia and racist comments is a very dangerous evolution. And cherry on the cake, Interior Minister Darmanin considers supermarkets with entire halal or kosher shelves as communitarian kitchen that might lead to separatism and to more terrorist acts. Anger continues to grow not only among French Muslims but also the Muslim world after Emmanuel Macron publicly attacked Islam in defense of the publication of derogatory cartoons of Prophet Muhammad. The second wave of the coronavirus goes hand in hand with a strong wave of Islamophobia and racism in France. For decades, French Muslims have been fully part of the society, but the actual rise of racism risks ruining this integration. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
On Wednesday, top Iranian and Italian academics and experts attended the fourth conference on cultural dialogue between Italy and Iran. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the event took place virtually. It was organized by the Alameh Tabatabai University in collaboration with the Sapienza University of Rome and the Cultural Institute of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Italy. The conference focused on literary and archaeological interactions between Iran and Italy.
It is widely accepted that Iran-Italy relations enjoy the longest durability in the history of Iran's relations, a durability that coincides with East-West relations in the world. The history of bilateral relations between the two countries dates back to over 2,000 years, which places one country as the cultural and civilizational representative of the East, and the other one as the intellectual and civilizational representative of the West.
Bonds in general, politically, economically, between Iran and Italy are very deep. Sometimes these are not very known, in particular the cultural bonds, because of political reasons. Sometimes they are not publicized just to avoid problems with partners of one country or the other. But these are very strong despite our other allies on one side of Iran and on the other side of Italy.
During the conference, Italian and Iranian academics touched on a number of cultural issues. Some drew a parallel between the influence of outstanding literary personalities such as the Italian humanist and writer Francesco Petrarca and renowned Persian poet Hafez on their respective regions of origin, while others focused on the well-established Italian-Iranian collaboration in the fields of cultural heritage and archaeology. Italy and Iran have for a long time been engaged in an archaeological touristic project in the Kermanshah province.
Our Kermanshah project, Sapienza's Kermanshah project, focuses on coupling cultural heritage development and research with sustainable tourism. So we took into consideration the whole road connecting Kastrishiri to Kartengavar, and we are studying this road as a whole and how important it was in antiquity and in the Middle Ages.
Italy and Iran also have a long history of commercial relations with economic interests playing a large role in the relations between the two countries. Max Civili, Rome.
Iranians from all walks of life took part in a rally in front of the French embassy in Tehran to protest against the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo and the publication of an image of the Prophet Muhammad. They also protested French President Emmanuel Macron for his support of secular laws that allow blasphemous caricatures to be published on the pretext of freedom of speech.
Just like their counterparts in other parts of the world, the protesters called for boycotting France and its products. They said governments should also condemn hate speech and discrimination against Muslims in Europe.
We are here to condemn Macron and members of his government for supporting blasphemous caricatures to be published under the pretext of freedom of expression. Such depictions are a form of hate speech and they are sacrilegious.
We are here to call for protests and boycott of French goods in response to France's stance on the offensive caricatures. God sent the Prophet Muhammad as an ambassador of peace. Macron and his cronies know nothing about Islam. They have no right to link Islam and terrorism.
It's really ridiculous.
that they name it freedom of speech. They should be aware that Muslims will be stronger than before, and Shia and Sunni are brothers.
Iran has summoned a French diplomat to protest France's stance on the caricatures. The country's foreign ministry told the top diplomat that France is permitting hatred against Islam under the guise of support for freedom of expression. It's a sentiment also shared by the protesters here.
It's a joke that offensive pictures can be published in France under the guise of freedom of speech. This is an attempt to call for targeting Muslims in the West through the deliberate offending of their religious beliefs and values. This has to stop. It will only lead to further hostility toward Muslims.
What happened in France underscores that they are very far from the teachings of the Bible. The Holy Book called for respecting all religions. Apparently, the French president and his cabinet members are not listening.
Mass protests have been held across the Muslim world to condemn the publication of the blasphemous cartoons and Macron's anti-Islam remarks. Shops and supermarkets have removed French goods from their shelves in several countries, including Palestine, Qatar, Yemen, Kuwait, and Jordan. Calls for a boycott are also being echoed in places like Iran, Pakistan, Iraq, and Algeria. Ammar Nadim, Tehran.
The salvo of criticism and condemnation comes on the heels of a nationwide crackdown launched by the French president on so-called radical Islam, with the promise of even tougher action following the murder of a teacher by a Chechen teenager on October 16.
As of tomorrow, at the cabinet meeting, we will dissolve the Sheikh Yassin collective directly implicated in the attack. More decisions against associations and groups of individuals will follow in the coming days and weeks. Our determination is complete. The acts will happen. The Republic needs them.
Vociferous reactions to that and his defense of Charlie Hebdo, the magazine that published insulting cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, came from Muslims around the world in the form of protests in Syria, Turkey, Iraq, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and elsewhere.
We don't allow anyone in our country to insult our Prophet, peace be upon him. We don't have enemies in any country, but we are angry about the insult to our Prophet by the French President Macron. We don't allow it.
That, coupled with unequivocal denunciation from Muslim leaders and statesmen. Iran's Foreign Minister Javad Zarif has called Charlie Hebdo's offensive depictions of the Prophet Muhammad as an opportunistic abuse of freedom of speech that would only fuel extremism. Turkey's president has become one of a number of other leaders to call for a boycott of French products. He's also suggested his French counterpart should have his brain examined.
From here, I call on my people. Do not praise French makes. Do not purchase these makes.
Despite the growing backlash, President Macron has refused to condemn the Charlie Hebdo cartoons and has instead urged an end to calls for a boycott of French products. France is home to Europe's largest Muslim community. It's also a country that has banned support for the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS movement, among other things, but allows the deliberate insulting of the beliefs of 1.8 billion Muslims in the name of freedom of speech. France observers say what's happening in the Western European country right now is causing more divisiveness, along with fears that what political leaders call zero tolerance for Islamic extremism will escalate into more violence.
Trump or Biden, Afghans don't care who will take power in Washington. That is because history has shown people of Afghanistan that no matter who becomes the president of the United States, their policy towards the war-ravaged country won't change. Since the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, three presidents took office in Washington. All of them promised to end decades of fighting in Afghanistan and bring peace and security to the war-torn country. So far, none has managed to fulfill such promise.
We remember what administrations of Bush and Obama promised. Yes, to uproot terrorism and build a new Afghanistan, a place that won't be considered as a safe haven for terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and Taliban.
I think none of U.S. presidential candidates will bring a positive change to our country. This is because they have so far proved to be only after their own interests. What we get is a constant rise of violence and misery.
Many Afghans also say that political figures in Afghanistan should abandon U.S. empty promises and find ways to build the country without foreign help.
It's better for a political elite to put an end to decades-long dependency to foreigners, mainly the U.S. The U.S. election will not positively change our lives here in Afghanistan, as Washington's priorities are in line with America's interests alone.
Nor Trump, neither Joe Biden will help Afghanistan. Dogs of the same street bark alike. During the last U.S. presidential election, when Hillary Clinton was competing with Trump, they said Trump will bring security to Afghanistan, but nothing happened.
The rise of pessimism on the outcome of the upcoming U.S. presidential election comes as Trump has already inked a peace deal with the Taliban. The U.S. president claims that the deal will pave the way for withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan.
The U.S.-Taliban peace deal proves that what Washington is doing is not for the sake of Afghans and only serves the U.S. interests. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The United States has reported the highest number of COVID-19 cases since the disease broke out. On Friday, October 23rd, Johns Hopkins University reported nearly 83,000 new infections, surpassing all previous records. The total number of deaths has exceeded 220,000. These figures illustrated how coronavirus situation is getting worse across the nation.
The United States has 4% of the world population, yet we are representing 20% of COVID infections / deaths. Yes, big question, what is going on? There are some countries that this is not happening in, North Korea, New Zealand, Canada. The difference, the big difference here is that we have no leadership whatsoever, and I am specifically speaking about the president who should be our leader, Donald Trump.
Estimates recently published in the specialized journal Nature Medicine by the University of Washington indicate that by February 2021, the coronavirus pandemic will have caused 500,000 deaths in the United States. The government's poor handling of the pandemic has made the situation much worse.
Right from the beginning, we had a nationwide, we had a leadership vacuum. No one, no one was really in charge. No mask mandates. That should have been 50 states, every person, got to have a mask, leave the house, you go into another building with other people, you wear a mask. There's lots of pros and cons for that, but it would stop some of the droplets from being in the atmosphere.
Although the United States is the worst hit country in terms of coronavirus infection and fatalities, and the number of victims keeps rising, Trump continues to hold campaign rallies with no consideration for social distancing rules. This comes as authorities have warned that the worst is yet to come this winter.
On Thursday, the Food and Drug Administration approved, under the Emergency Act, using the drug Remdesivir to treat COVID-19, the first and only medication so far to receive federal approval for the coronavirus. Reporting from Miami, Ronnie Corvello.
France has triggered a fierce debate about double standards against Islam and whether freedom of expression is a license to insult Islam and its nearly 2 billion followers. Last week, French President Emmanuel Macron openly backed the blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. He took this stance after the cartoons, first published in 2015, once again emerged in public, this time by a history teacher using them to teach freedom of expression. The teacher was later killed by a young refugee of Chechen origin. Macron sparked outrage in the Muslim world by backing the teacher's move as upholding freedom of speech.
We will defend the freedom that you taught so well and will hold secularism high. We will not give up caricatures, drawings, even if others retreat.
Macron's comments go strangely against France's lack of tolerance when it comes to any religion other than Islam. Back in 2019, a citizen was sentenced to prison for publishing a cartoon that teased backers of Holocaust as disoriented historians. On Sunday, Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan summarized things when he called on social media giant Facebook to ban Islamophobic contents, just as was the case with anti-Holocaust messages.
One cannot send a message that while hate messages against some are unacceptable, they're acceptable against others.
Iran, Turkey, Kuwait, and Jordan were among other nations condemning Macron's remarks and the continued publication of the Prophet Muhammad's blasphemous cartoons.
Muslims are the primary victims of the cult of hatred, empowered by colonial regimes and exported by their own clients, insulting 1.9 billion Muslims and their sanctities for the apparent crimes of such extremists is an opportunistic abuse of freedom of speech. It only fuels extremism.
The Jordanian Islamic Affairs Minister said insulting the Prophet Muhammad is a crime and not an issue of personal freedom. That was an echo of what Lebanon's Hezbollah and Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has said. Turkey's president also called for boycotting French products.
I'm calling on all my citizens, just like they say don't buy goods with Turkish brands in France. I'm calling to all my citizens from here to never help French brands or buy them.
Meanwhile, protests have taken place in different places, including Bangladesh and Libya. In Qatar and Kuwait, several stores have removed French goods from their shelves. Also, Kuwaiti travel agencies have suspended reservations for flights to France. Ordinary people in other Muslim countries have voiced support for the boycott campaign against France.
This is the least we can do in support of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. The French people have to respect our religion and our principles. They have freedom of speech in this regard, and we also do have the freedom of speech. They express by cartoons and we express in ceremony. Eventually, we will see who is stronger.
Macron's recent anti-Islam comments are not his first. In September, he defended reprinting of the blasphemous cartoons by French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, saying blasphemy is no crime. Macron has also called Islam a religion in crisis worldwide, triggering warnings that his Islamophobic campaign could unleash attacks on Muslims and cost their lives.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
A very fundamental and important point on which some people are casting a doubt whether Iran achieved victory in the war or not is that the Islamic Republic's victory in the imposed war is as clear as the existence of the sun. The entire power structure of the world launched an all-out attack in order to overthrow our country's political system, achieve domination over it, and disintegrate its lands. They wanted to disintegrate some western and southwestern areas of the country, and they utilized all their power in order to do so, but they could not do a damn thing in the end. Is there a victory superior to this? Is this not a victory? The Iranian nation achieved a brilliant victory. First of all, they could not separate one single inch of the country. Secondly, they failed to make the revolution and the Islamic Republic take even one step backwards.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger among
After the end of the war, after those 8 years, the Islamic Republic was much stronger and much more capable than before the war, and it proved to be even stronger and more enthusiastic. These are the astounding victories that were achieved. In the wars waged during the era of kings and taghuts in the past one, two centuries, Iran had always suffered a defeat. This happened both during Qajar and Pahlavi eras. It even happened in the war in which Iran announced its neutrality. Both during the First and Second Wars, Iran announced its neutrality, but the country was occupied in both wars. The first occurred in the time of the Qajar dynasty, and the second in the time of the Pahlavi dynasty.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
ministry.
Lebanon has come full circle. A year ago, a million Lebanese thronged the streets and demanded the removal of the entire political class. Now, Saad Hariri, the prime minister who resigned soon after the uprising engulfed the country, is back in the game. Former Lebanese prime minister Saad Hariri is back by unpopular demand, pledging to do better this time, given that this is the fourth time as premier. As Lebanon reels from its months of political paralysis, its worst financial crisis in decades, the coronavirus pandemic, and the aftermath of the deadly August 4 explosion at the port of Beirut. The sight of Saad Hariri, who leads the Sunni Future Movement, sitting grim-faced next to President Michel Aoun and Parliament Speaker Nabil Berri, did little to bring hope to Lebanese suffering under a dire economic meltdown. However, Hariri promised otherwise. Hold on now. Hariri resigned a year ago in answer to the popular protests. How is his return supposed to be the solution to Lebanon's problems, which have only gotten worse since then? Hariri is back as prime minister in large part because there's not really anybody else whom the Lebanese political parties would agree on. Hassan Diab, who succeeded Hariri last fall, resigned himself after the August explosion, which killed almost 200 people and was widely seen as the result of government incompetence and corruption. After him came Mustafa Adib, then and now again Lebanon's ambassador to Germany, but he couldn't form a new cabinet and stepped down as prime minister late last month. Hariri is an old hand in Lebanon's political game and more likely to accommodate the demands of the traditional political parties than Adib was. But success in forming a cabinet is not guaranteed. It will be a balancing act of political interests. The process could go on for months. If it is unsuccessful, Lebanon could see its fourth prime minister in less than a year and more delays on its road to recovery. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Former Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri, who was toppled in a popular uprising nearly 1 year ago, has been tasked with forming the crisis-plagued country's next government. Hariri's dramatic return was enabled by the votes of 65 members of parliament from across the country's political spectrum. Hariri now faces the grueling task of forming a cabinet in a country still reeling from the aftermath of a massive explosion that tripped through the capital in August. The country is mired in a financial meltdown, political infighting, and widespread anger at Beirut's ruling elite. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Daniel Yagic, academic and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Daniel. Now, toppled a year ago, but back in business last week as Prime Minister designate of Lebanon. What is expected of Saad al-Hariri as he tries to formulate this new government, and what do you think are his own expectations for his role as the upcoming prime minister of this crisis-laden country?
Thank you, Marwa. Well, as the former and newly appointed prime minister, Saad Hariri is currently confronted with a multitude of crises, from an hyperinflation to an economic crisis and a decline to a near collapse of the country, and several socio-political problems that are of structural nature. So he's in a position that is much worse than it was a year ago when he resigned after a popular demands to do so. Now, some of these socio-political problems are of structural nature and had been present and had been developing unhindered during his former terms. So the question is, to what extent there are obviously expectations, but there seems to be less enthusiasm or hope at this point for his government to bring about a broad change. And the question is also, to what extent Hariri, who is part of the political establishment and of the 1%, would be in a position or would have the capacity to bring about such a change or to alter structures that had brought him and kept him in power.
Well, Daniel, Hariri himself said that he would build an apolitical and technocratic government to enact wide-ranging reforms. So look, as a Lebanese, I don't really trust that anymore. But the move puts him at loggerheads with opponents in the country's Hezbollah-backed parliamentary majority, who have repeatedly rejected proposals for a technocrat cabinet. Will this be maybe another logjam in the country's road towards receiving very important financial aid, at least to keep the country from completely collapsing?
A good question. I wonder what apolitical even means. I guess in some somehow these terms apolitical, corrupt, and legitimate that have been recently used in political discussions and discourse on Lebanon are politicized in themselves. I wonder to what extent an apolitical government is possible at this time. But of course, the government formation in itself has always been quite a struggle in Lebanon, given the sectarian structures and the mere fact that Lebanon is a parliamentary democracy that has democratic elections. However, the outcome of the elections is not necessarily reflected in the government formation. And I guess the 2018 elections are a good example of this, where the March 8 coalition gained an absolute majority in the parliament, and Hezbollah received the highest number of votes as an individual party. And yet there has been a compromised government in which several parties participated, which meant that there has been always has been a challenge to form a government comprised of parties that are ideologically opposed to each other. And this might have even to a certain extent facilitated corruption somehow. But then also, the government in itself is obviously also restricted because it needs to secure foreign backing and to please foreign actors that have agendas in Lebanon in order to unlock aid. So the question really is it about financial aid that comes with conditions, and to what extent would financial aid even solve these problems that are much deeper and much more structural than just the financial crisis?
I definitely hear you there, but let's be positive and say Hariri actually succeeds in creating the next government, where he will be taking on the premiership for a fourth time. But a staple of the country's political class, Hariri is the son of the assassinated former Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri, who himself is the main perpetrator in creating this financial loophole in Lebanon by empowering the central bank and empowering bankers over the actual governmental institutions. What do you think the first step that the Lebanese government should take to at least ease pressure off the public, especially the depositors who lost all of their savings?
Yes, so I guess the first step really depends on how far-reaching the intentions of this government are going to be and what the eventual aim is. And as you said, Hariri is part of the political establishment. He's a billionaire. He also has two foreign citizenships of two countries which themselves have been invested in Lebanese politics. And he inherited this political position and has as well been involved in sectarian politics. And in many ways, I guess, Hariri as a prime minister also symbolizes many of these failures that have been developing throughout the last three decades, without saying that he himself is responsible for them. But there is a correlation here, and I wonder to what extent, how far-reaching these steps are going to be. Is it about the situation? Is it about to ease the financial struggle, to postpone the collapse, to secure foreign aid? Because eventually there is also the foreign involvement, and the reach of the Lebanese government is effectively restricted by foreign involvement in Lebanese politics. And I guess as long as there is an orientation towards Western imposed structures and Western imposed financial system, the question really is to what extent the reach of the Lebanese government is restricted, regardless of who is heading that government.
That's mainly the point here, Daniel, because the former prime minister, who shunned the premiership for most of the last year, they were asking him to come back, and he refused after he stepped down in October 2019. He has vowed to push through reform.